Welcome to United Bodies, a podcast about the lived experience of health. I'm Kendall Seesmeyer, your host. Hey, this is so exciting. The first episode of United Bodies. This is a project I've been dreaming about for so long, and I'm just so happy to be sharing it with you. You see, I was born into illness and disability, and it's been a strong force in my life. Health of all varieties shapes our daily experience in ways that so often go unacknowledged. That's why I created United Bodies, to bring out more conversation. Together, throughout the season, we'll explore how different components of our health, mental, physical, social, and spiritual, interplay with one another and intersect with the whole of our identity. It's my belief that when we understand these forces in our lives, we can meet both ourselves and others with more empathy, and maybe even realize that our fights for equity, justice, freedom, and accessibility are united. The first half of our season is focused on addressing and navigating the world we have. The second half will be focused on envisioning and building the world we need. There will be a new episode each week, and I think some of the guests and topics will surprise you. With that, let us begin. One of the most present themes in our lived experience of health over the last few years is the war on bodily autonomy. Whether it's the overturn of Roe v. Wade and the loss of legal abortion for millions, or the repeated pernicious efforts to ban gender-affirming care for trans and non-binary people. But the origins of the ideology driving these attacks is actually not new. It lies in the history of eugenics, racism, and ableism. And in many ways, it's experienced in the everyday lives of disabled people. You can think of us as, you know, canaries in the coal mine, if you will. Disability activist and creator Imani Barberin says, "None of this is surprising. We've been dealing with it for a long time." Imani Barberin is also famously known as Crutches and Spice, everywhere online, including her blog, where altogether she's amounted nearly 1 million followers by delivering the truthiest takes on culture and politics as it pertains to Black and disabled people. She joins me to discuss all of this and more. Imani, welcome to United Bodies, and thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. Lovely to be here.
So, Imani, a lot has happened in the last few years. It seems that every day there's a new assault to our bodily autonomy and our body safety. As people born into disability, I think this might not be surprising to you. It certainly isn't surprising to me. I feel like it was a truth that I picked up through observation as a child, an experience as a child. I was wondering if we could begin our conversation with talking about the world that you were born into and who and what might have taught you lessons about body autonomy or body safety early on.
Yeah, so I am a disabled Black woman. I grew up in suburban Pennsylvania. And my family, I was fairly middle class. I was very privileged growing up. And my parents did a lot to protect my body autonomy. I remember yesterday I was in a live and I was talking to people and I was trying to tell them. My dad used to fight people who would try to grab me and like pick me up from my walker because they wanted to have like that feel good moment of like hugging a disabled child. And my parents were like, "No, leave her alone. She's walking. You know, you're going to disturb her. You're going to put her off balance." And it's really weird because my parents were very, very stringent about people not touching me and me being able to say no to people touching me. But then I learned that people get belligerent and angry when they don't have access to like physically touching a disabled person. And so after a while, you start to learn that if they want to lay hands and pray over me, it'll just go faster. Every single person you meet comments on your body in some way. And it never ends. It like, if you're fat, if you're disabled, if you're Black, it never ends. The commentary, the conversations. And so you really never grow up as a disabled person, particularly as a disabled Black person, feeling like your body is not under some consideration at all times.
And what a difficult thing to contend with as an adult now, but especially as a kid, right? To like not perhaps, I mean, I know that I felt this way, never really feel like you have ownership over your own self in a lot of ways, like that you're not the sole owner. You don't always get to determine or choose what happens. It's so tough. And I think that messaging, it really ingrains itself in us.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because my mom and dad were very adamant on me making my own medical decisions from very early on. Mm. I would be in the doctor's office and the doctor would be like, oh, you know, Imani's parents, here, sign this consent form for surgery. And my mom would look at me and go, do you want me to sign this? You don't have to say yes. Mm. Do you want this surgery? This is what the surgery actually is and what it's going to do. And here's how long it's going to take. Here's what the promises are of the surgery. Because one of the things that people don't realize is that operations and medical care is nothing more than a promise. Than like, it's more of just a theory of what could happen. Mm-hmm. Things can go awry at all times. So you want to know the pros and cons. And even at 4 years old, people try to explain it to me. My parents specifically try to explain that to me as best as possible.
It sounds like you have really great parents. I also have really great parents and feel very grateful for that, especially in contending with everything else. You know, it's very much your history and it's our collective history as disabled people. The fight for autonomy and safety is still ongoing. There were moments as I grew up that I think eventually connected my personal experience to the historical experience. And it wasn't in school. We didn't learn disability history. And suddenly, I think, to me, really clicked as like, oh, the behavior that I had contended with or experienced in the ecosystem I lived in, it all made sense at some point. I could trace it back to an origin in history where things were much more obvious and much worse in a lot of ways, right? Do you remember learning disability history? And I guess I wonder what it did for you to understand that collective struggle.
Yeah, it was never really intentional that I learned disability history. I learned a lot of Black history, and there's always mentions of illnesses or disabilities, but it wasn't really discussed explicitly in the conversations being had about Black history. But I remember in college, I learned disability history through other means. I learned it through like communications course, because I wanted to talk about like the perceptions of disability in pop culture and media and film and TV. And my professor was like, go for it. He was like, just go for it. I don't care. Like, he's like, just, I want you to really explore what you want to explore. Just hand in your assignment on time. And that's really when I started being like, oh, I'm not alone in experiencing this. People treating me outside of the realm of normality is not new. It has a historical basis. And the more you kind of peel back what your daily interactions are informed by, the more you feel less alone. And so that's kind of where that all started for me, was in college when I was like, let me look into what I'm experiencing. And even when I was younger, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on disability history, but I would be forced to explain to my classes, like in kindergarten and first grade, what my disability was. And they would do like a disability share day, because just explain what's going on with Imani and why she's out of class, you know, three times a week for physical therapy or occupational therapy. And so, but I never really connected that to the historical context until I was much older.
Yeah. And who were people or figures or leaders that you looked up to in that way, or maybe saw yourself in, if you did find those figures in your life?
The very first thing that I really remembered like attaching to was Audre Lorde and her story about the cancer journals and reading about her experience, kind of reevaluating herself. It's really strange because I don't know if you've had this experience, but as somebody who was born with my disability, you never get to adjust into disability. You just are. You just have a disability. And so it's kind of fascinating to kind of watch this construction of self in real time, and how you had to set up boundaries and space for yourself when it was just a given. Like, that's just what you have to do to survive.
There was no before.
Right.
I think in a lot of people, they have stories of a before and an after. I think that being born and having that and just inherent in your experience, it feels different to me.
It does.
You know, I often think of disability narratives and the stories that we see and how they're talked about, or how we're even just expressed in like generalized conversation, news conversation, cultural conversation. And so often I feel like we rely on there being a before in order to appreciate what someone had to lose. Like, we have to have known them before and in order to care about the loss of it all, I guess.
Yes.
You know, obviously that angers me as someone who feels like, well, there wasn't a before. So there's an assumption that it's kind of like these things are okay because they're just have always been. I don't know if that relates to you in any way.
I think for me, it's not necessarily an anger that comes forth. It's more like who I've been defined by. What I've been defined by has been my disability the entire time. And so watching people develop a disability identity in real time isn't frustrating in the sense that I never had that. It's watching people realize that this was what has always existed.
Yeah.
What I find the most frustrating, though, is that people develop their disability identity in real time, but they don't unlearn their ableism in real time. That usually gets to come later.
Yeah.
That's where I get frustrated, where I'm like, you don't have this choice. You don't have the choice of believing the same narratives that you did before. Your survival depends on what exists and what is right now. And people have always been like really perturbed with me because I say to people, if your immediate reaction to becoming disabled is to look for a cure, you're going to set yourself up for failure. And it's not because I don't think cures exist or that treatments exist or that doing better exists in your own body, but oftentimes what I find is that the experience of ableism in society, the lack of autonomy and being believed and being seen, is so jarring to people that their first reaction is, I want to get rid of this immediately, no matter what, and I'm going to forego every single thing that would make my life easier in terms of accessibility and community and accommodations, because I'm going to just fast track my life towards searching for this cure.
Yeah.
And that's where I've always seen the most frustration, is you have to unlearn that, because it's going to be slow going and you're going to frustrate yourself the entire time. And so that was a long tangent, but that's kind of where my frustration comes from. Isn't from like watching the privilege of being able to just now come to this conclusion. It is still wanting the privilege to exist in a disabled body.
Yeah. You know, I think I want to talk a little bit about the pandemic, the pandemonium, the panini. Panera bread, the panini, whatever you want to, however you want to call it.
The Panda Express.
There you go. Good. Very good. You know, I think it's exposed this disdain that felt maybe a little bit under the surface. I think the burden narrative that follows disabled people became very loud during the pandemic and has been. What's it been like for you to see it operate so loudly and so pervasively in this time?
Oh boy. There's just like this underlying rage, I feel, because on the one hand, you knew this was going to happen, right? You know exactly how people are going to react to being told that disabled and elderly and people who were immunocompromised are going to be the primary victims of the pandemic.
Once they said that, the very first moment, I was like, we're screwed.
Like, it was literally, I'm not even joking. It almost felt like in that moment, I was connected to every single disabled person on the planet and just going, shit.
No.
Like, because you know exactly how people are going to act. People do not even like to be minorly inconvenienced to help disabled people out or just to abide by legal restrictions on accessibility, let alone putting their lives on hold to make sure that we are safe and alive. And watching that happen in real time, it's almost kind of like watching dominoes fall. You know which ones are going to fall next. Like, you can see it, you could hear it, you could feel it. And So from there, you can go, oh, since they're not going to take any precautions for disabled people, this is going to impact Black people, mm-hmm. queer people, Indigenous people. This is, and then like the next week, that exact thing would happen. Like that exact data would happen. Or, and then you'd find, oh, well, the religious organizations are not going to, you know, enforce masking at churches and things like that. And then that thing would happen, you know, and mm-hmm. then you started with the anti-vax rhetoric and, you know, you hear things that you've heard for years from mm-hmm. people who, you know, we won't name communities, but you know who you are. Mm-hmm. But you hear things you've heard for years being played on this massive scale. And all of it leads to the deaths of disabled people and people of color and queer people and trans people, because we are the most impacted by disability statistically. Mm-hmm. And so you're trying to warn people. And normally, you know, before the pandemic, there was a lot of thought within the disability community saying we shouldn't have to tell people that they could possibly become disabled in order to care about disabled people. But with the pandemic, it became imperative, because the only way we could get people to care was to center themselves, was to center what their own experience was going to be with disability later on. And even still, people are like, well, whatever.
I eat healthy food, so I'm going to be fine. I run, you know, I run. And, you know, I think disabled people inherently know that, like, our bodies are so not in our control, and you can't keep your body from bodying all over you. There's nothing you can do to, you know, prevent that. And I think that that's a really hard pill for people to swallow. You know, I understand it. I empathize it with it. But I thought that, I mean, that piece of rhetoric was really interesting. The like, I'm going to be fine.
Yeah.
It's been definitely really challenging to watch. I think also the narrative around like, well, that's not my problem. I can go out and live my life.
Yeah.
You can stay home. As if disabled people don't have jobs or lives oh, yeah. or families, or just like literally they stay home all the time anyway, and they're in the shadows of like the assumption was just so interesting to me and really telling.
But it also connects to that historical context and learning about disability historically, right? Because you learn about the ugly laws and institutions and institutionalization.
Yes.
They literally do not realize we live among them. Like, we are erased from their minds.
Absolutely. Also during this time, during the beginnings of the pandemic, on display, again and again, the horrific disregard for Black lives, the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. It put a real spotlight again on the issue that continues. How did this all coalesce for you as a Black disabled woman? Like, how do you see the movements as connected?
I remember the summer of 2020, I was working, and I remember coming back to work because I think it was July 4th or that weekend, and it was some day off. And then the next day, everything was back to normal. And I literally could not think straight. And it wasn't the first time that I'd experienced that, where I watched a Black person be killed by police and then go back to work the next day and everything is normal. No, nothing changes for anybody else, but mm-hmm. for Black people who are engaged in these conversations. And it was fascinating because people have always thought that police violence and disability do not really go hand in hand, when data indicates that they're literally woven together. And I find it interesting because
it's actually 50% of police killings are disabled people.
Yeah, or people in a mental health crisis. Yeah, and it's, and you watch, and you're watching as Black people acquire PTSD from watching these things. And then you watch as, like you said, half of people are killed by police. Then you watch as people are disabled from police.
Mm-hmm.
And it's everything. It touches everything. And you watch as neighborhoods who are redlined have a historically high rate of asthma and respiratory illnesses. And you watch as racism disables people both mentally and physically. And it's hard because in the Black community, talking about disability is still relatively taboo.
Mm.
It's not something that you openly admit to. And so conversations along these lines are very difficult to have, because not only do you get the sentiment that it's not that disability doesn't matter. It's that disability has killed us for so long that you can't admit to another weakness. Mm. You can't admit to another way in which you are other. And having those conversations can be very difficult because you have to say, sometimes you have to say the word disability if you need the services. And the system doesn't help in the sense that it's meant to discard of us. It's meant to discard of Black and brown people who are applying for benefits and help and assistance. And we have continuously pumped money into the criminal justice system, justice being a very loose term, you know, as our greatest, our largest mental health system is the prison system. And 30 to 40% of people in jails and prisons have a disability, and people are thrust into poverty by the system as it exists. People get desperate. Crime is going to go up. Like it's always been orchestrated for our removal from society. Mm-hmm. And so watching in the summer of 2020 and watching these things happen, it's not surprising. It's very draining to watch. And I think greater conversations need to be had along the axis of race and disability and literally everything in disability. I have always said that white supremacy is the goal and ableism is the toolkit. I mean, the way in which the system is designed, it's designed to do just this. And if you ignore it, you're ignoring the toolkit people are using against you. Take it away.
Yeah. And we see that in like the eugenics movement in our country, mm-hmm. that sought to sterilize and still does seek to sterilize Black, poor, and disabled people.
Yeah.
It's definitely very prevalent and was present in our past. And it is still operating as a system of violence, I think, today.
100%. And I know that with COVID, people want it to be over. But knowing how the system works, knowing how the racist biases of our healthcare system, you can know that like 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, the people who are going to be most impacted by COVID will have experienced racism or queerphobia or transphobia. The people who are most marginalized are going to have the hardest time 5-10 years from now from COVID. Mm-hmm. And you want to warn people against it, but at the same time, you're like, I can't convince you that you matter. You have to decide that yourself.
Yeah. I want to pick up on that. Like, you know, I think oftentimes it's been interesting for me to watch, you know, operating in fairly progressive spaces, mm-hmm. Watching disability kind of really not be recognized in, you know, the long list of identity, social justice movements, categories of difference, if you will. What do you think is, I mean, I have my own thoughts, but I'm just really curious that I have you in front of me. Why do you think that is, Imani? Like, why are even the most progressive folks that are allies and are, you know, really have been showing up for movements that are outside of their own movements, right? Like, why is it still such an issue, it seems?
How do I put this? Because you have to do something. Like when people say, I want more Black people in the room in this conversation, I want more queer people in the room in this conversation, by and large, all it requires is saying, I need to contact the right people. I need to make sure that I'm being intentional about the right people in the room. They can get themselves there. They can make sure that I don't have to plan for accessibility. I don't have to plan for logistics. We'll just make sure that they're there, right?
Yeah.
And I think with disabled people, calling for inclusion of disabled people requires you do something about wanting us in the room. It's not just a matter of inviting us to a conversation or to a training. It's a matter of, is that training accessible and safe? Is that training going to have our needs met in terms of, you know, food allocation and ramps and ASL and captions? You have to do something more than just say you want us there. You have to actually build spaces to have us there. That's one aspect of it. I think also, too, historically, we're not seen. We're not discussed. We are hidden from society. We are in the shadows of society. And to this day, we are in situations where we can't really leave our neighborhoods or our homes. Transportation is very difficult to get. It's not accessible. It's not paratransit. It's not as prevalent in a lot of areas. And then you have people taking a very paternalistic view towards disabled people, where you have people are talking about disability, but they're not talking to disabled people. They're talking about parents and doctors and nurses, therapists, occupational therapists, right? So it hurt. If you know, these things are interconnected, they hurt all of us. And if people don't think about it, mm-hmm. they get to just live in the land of privilege in which everything's just okay, you know?
Totally. You know, until disability comes for them, because, you know, unfortunately, we're all, I don't think any of us are immune to experience disability in varying degrees in our life. And I sometimes wonder if that is also part of it, is this like, I can't look that way because that way reminds me of my own inherent vulnerability to have a disability or to, I don't know, die, like our own mortality, right? Like it's so connected. And I sometimes wonder if it's just so hard for people to have to contend with that, that we act as some, as reminders of what their kind of like quote unquote worst nightmare is. And of course, I want to be really clear about this. This is only a reaction based on the structure of ableism that is so pervasive, because if we had a world that actually was accessible and was inclusive and did work for all of us, it wouldn't be such a fear of our bodies bodying, right? Like,
yeah,
the ebbing and flowing of our bodies wouldn't be such a terrorizing experience.
Non-disabled people or people who think they're non-disabled engage in a lot of very dangerous behaviors when you're actually thinking about it to avoid being seen as disabled, or they promote very dangerous ideas.
I mean, there's so much to be said there. I think especially in the age of the like wellness industrial complex, it can get really, really, there's just so much fodder for people now. I think there's so much ability for people to really latch on to different kinds of practices or ideologies, or to really take that fear and run with it. So when we're thinking about the time we're living in, we've got the pandemic, we've got attacks on bodily autonomy from a perspective of banning gender-affirming healthcare for trans people, attacks on our reproductive freedom. It's like a very devastating and difficult time. And I feel like what is just so discouraging to me, and I'm curious what your take is here, but I really felt like, oh gosh, if we didn't learn, if we're missing all the lessons that the pandemic could potentially collectively teach us, because we're reckoning with a system that is clearly not working for any of us, and that's being missed, it really concerns me about our ability to fight all of these other fronts. And I wonder, like, how you feel about the moment that we're living in and our, you know, perhaps lack of ability to really have learned anything in all this.
Yeah, I do think, I personally think the pandemic accelerated all of these attacks on body autonomy, because there's this underlying sentiment that if bad things happen to somebody medically, it's their fault. And that goes into, you know, protecting, quote unquote, protecting children from trans ideology and protecting birthing people from their own reproductive system and making sure that they do what they're supposed to do as people with uteruses. And I don't think any of this would be happening at the rate that it is, like I said, without the pandemic. And we decided collectively through propaganda, through corporate propaganda, that we're going to ignore all the lessons that we've learned. We're going to ignore them. We're going to ricochet right back to where we were. Because if we think about what happened during the pandemic, if we actually sat down and think about how every single institution failed, it didn't just hold on by a thread, it actively failed, then we would be motivated to change things. We would be motivated to take time to think about how things could be better. And these attacks on autonomy are really nothing new for disabled people. They're nothing new for our community. You know, they're stripping of rights through conservatorships and guardianships, and not being able to, in some states, vote because somebody deems you too disabled or too, quote unquote, unintelligent, or having the wrong type of disability for your voice to matter. And what I would have hoped is that people took a radical stance on disability inclusion and inclusion of even children, because those two things are linked, the infantilization of children and their own choices that they want for their own bodies and society at large and disability. You know, those things, two things are linked because we deem it as a question of intelligence or intellect rather than this is a person that has needs and desires and goals for themselves. How do we incorporate their voice into the larger question of who we are as a society? I don't know. I feel like we could have done something. And I will never not be bitter that we decided to ignore what we learned.
Mm-hmm.
We learned so much about one another. We learned so much about how we could support one another and how much of our time is wasted behind desks, you know, and not with our families. Like that was the biggest revelation, is that it didn't have to be like this. None of it had to be like this.
None of it had to be like this.
And so I think it all plays into this larger picture of what do we want to be and who do we want to be as a society? And it requires this inclusion of us as disabled people that I don't think people are ready to contend with.
Yeah, it's sad. If the pandemic isn't radicalizing people, especially in the early days, right? Like there was just, you could say that today in society, people could feel immune to the repercussions of the pandemic, that some people with a lot of privilege could feel immune to the repercussions, but not in the beginning. In the beginning, there was a level of playing field that we were all operating on, the same playing field in different ways, but it had to touch everyone. And I just can't imagine that didn't help radicalize people. It's just so upsetting.
Over 1 million people died like it was nothing.
And yet, you know, significantly less people die in other historical events, and we have memorialized them and actually changed entire national security strategies. And, you know, that is a whole other thing. But like,
yeah,
a lot of shifts have been made for far less death.
Yeah. It's disheartening, I think. It's really sad.
Yeah. And I guess like with that, you know, where do you find hope or the kind of like continued persistence? How do you live with that being true and also continue to deliver and continue to show up and continue to push us forward? I mean, I really see you as a leader.
Oh, thank you.
And I think that your content is so necessary. And so every time, you know, I watch something, I'm like, yeah, you tell them. It's just a lot of things that need to be said that no one has been saying and needed kind of someone bold enough to like actually tell the truth. And I feel so grateful for your voice. How do you keep doing it amidst just the hopeless feeling, you know?
Well, it's, how do I put this? I am never going to stop. And it's almost pathological at this point that like, because I've told people like, oh, I want to step away from advocacy a little bit. It's very emotionally and physically draining. And it's very difficult to have the same conversations over and over and over again. And people looked at me in my eye and go, no, you're not. That's not a thing.
They just totally see right through that. They're like, that's interesting. I'll ask you tomorrow.
Right. And I'm like, that's so rude of you to like call me out on that. Prior to me going to grad school, I remember sitting at my desk at work and I just very intentionally said to myself, I want to tell better disabled stories. I want to tell the truth about disability. And this was like my first job. And I saw myself not really going anywhere with that job and kind of being stuck. And I said, I can make a job out of telling better disabled stories that matter to us and not to non-disabled people so that they feel better. Like, I could care less. And every single day that I am on social media or that I'm writing or that I am putting in the work in some way, I orient myself around that. And so that's kind of where my energy comes from, is it has to be disabled people. It's always going to have to be disabled people for me. And that's where the community comes from and the energy comes from. And just commiserating with other disabled people, I think, is just so fun because you feel so validated in your daily experience. Because being disabled, it means being gaslit every single day about what is possible versus what you are told to settle for. The behaviors, the interactions, the supports. I'm so grateful for disabled people that they trust me and that you all trust me. And that you interact with me and have conversations with me and tell me your stories and you tell me what matters to you, because that's all I wanted as a kid, and that's all I wanted to talk about and to have a vocabulary to discuss. So I'm forever grateful, and that's where it all comes from.
I guess my last question, just out of personal curiosity, really, you know, I think for people who might be listening to you, maybe they have a disability. I don't know where they are on their journey, identity journey, but I think hearing you have such confidence and have such a presence and such conviction about your opinions and your beliefs and your experiences and what you're doing can feel like, wow, I can't imagine ever feeling that level of confidence or that level of conviction, or, you know, to put my neck out there or say the thing that I feel needs to be said, whether that's online or in rooms or at their workplace or in school or in their personal relationships. Where has that come from for you, and how have you really like nurtured that part of yourself? Because it is challenging.
Yeah.
So for some people, it comes naturally. You know, we all have God-given gifts, right? Or inherent gifts. But how do you nurture that?
I come from a long line of very, how do I put this in a way that I won't get a phone call later? Very bold Black women. Like, there was never a question to remain meek or mild. You have to say what you're going to say. And my grandmother is like that. My mother is like that. My aunts. I'm West Indian, so my aunts are all like that, however way that manifests for them. But I think, too, a good way to think about it is I started advocating for other disabled people, if that makes sense. I didn't start with Crutches and Spice. I started with a different blog, actually. I started writing about tips to, like, interact with disabled people better and how to be nicer and how to be kinder. And then I was like, why am I doing this? This is crap. Like, it felt so outside of me because I was advocating for disabled people in a way that centered non-disabled people. And I realized if I was going to advocate, I would want to advocate in such a way that disabled people felt empowered, not non-disabled people. I couldn't care less. And the more I started doing that, the more I started realizing I'm a part of this community. And if I wouldn't stand for this behavior or this treatment towards other disabled people, if I could see it outside of myself, then I don't deserve that treatment myself. Like, I deserve to stand up for myself and advocate for myself as well.
Mm.
And that could also set an example about how disabled people should be treated. And that centering me in some ways was part of the advocacy. It was part of making sure people had the skill set to do the same, or at least find ways in which they can manifest it in their own lives. And so sometimes we find the strength outside of ourselves because we realize that if we are going to put ourselves on the line to advocate for other people, then we deserve a baseline of respect and inclusion ourselves. And so sometimes you have to find it outside of you.
I think that's a really good piece of advice. I really, really like that. And I think that mirrors my journey as well in different ways, but very similar, like feeling more comfortable advocating for other people first, before even being able to acknowledge, oh, wait, I actually have been really impacted, and this does really apply, and this is really resonant, and I do deserve to also vocalize those things for myself. That's cool. That's very cool. Oh, you're the best, Imani. I would love to just sit here and gab away all day long, but I really appreciate you joining and sharing all of this with us and helping us understand how this all is connected.
And thank you for having me. I greatly appreciate it. We have to stick together.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to United Bodies wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be so helpful to us if you would rate and review the show. That helps more people like you find us. We'll be back next week with more. United Bodies is a Ms. Magazine and Ms. Studios production. The show is created and produced by me, Kendall Seismeyer. Michelle Goodwin is our executive producer.